That's out.
Oh, he dropped it. I don't believe it. That's unbelievable. He was throwing it up. He thought he had it. It was a little lollipop. And the man who did so well with the bat has taken his eye off the ball. And the ball has just dribbled out of his fingers. He was about to throw it up.
Hey, great cricket.
The Great Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the great cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello, welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast. On today's show, we're going to be talking all about Australia's massive, massive, enormous victory over Bangladesh by 48 runs there at Trent Bridge. My name's Ian Higgins. I'm joined by Sam Perry, who is in Melbourne. Pez, good morning to you. Well, that is, the World Cup's done now, and the whole tournament rests on three games, the two semis and a final.
Good morning, Higgos. A less elaborate introduction. And that's because we podcasted 24 hours ago and it is the only thing that's happened.
Yes.
Australia playing Bangladesh. That's the World Cup done for the round robin matches. Yeah, that's right. I understand that there is a road for Bangladesh to the finals, but it involves beating England and India. So they've been valiant, Bangladesh, and they put up a pretty good fight here. But and I know there's a lot of people listening to this show going, how are they going to spin Australia's performance to be shit here? Well, I've had to think about it. Well, you can't. Australia registered their highest ever ODI total.
Yep.
381 for five. I've said it that way around, mainly to annoy people.
Sure.
In Australia, that is. And you know, Bangladesh didn't look like getting near it, nor would many chasing 381 for five. The question remains, would that performance be good enough against the other two teams whose name we not mention?
Hmm.
Who knows? Who cares? Let's just enjoy it and get behind the boys.
Well, let's get behind the boys. Mate, I've been thinking about this tournament for a long time now, probably because I've been podcasting about it, so it helps to think about the thing that you're producing. But
it helps.
But, you know, Australia now have beaten everyone that they should have beaten, really. I mean, they had a bit of a scare against the West Indies, obviously, when they were 4 for 50 or something, and then they managed to get themselves to a score, then defend that score despite the West Indies looking pretty comfortable in that chase. So they played really well that game to dig themselves out of a hole. But, you know, they've won the games that they should have done, and then they lost to India. So, like, I kind of been saying before that I think that if Australia make the semi, you know, that's just about where this team's at. And it looks like that's now an inevitability. They're now, what are they, 5 points ahead of Bangladesh, who'll need to win their... Bangladesh need to win all three of their last games, and Australia have to lose all three of theirs for Bangladesh to overtake Australia. So that's a done deal now, you'd think. I mean, Australia have done okay. You know, they've done all right. I mean, if Australia beats South Africa as well, I think they've had a pretty decent tournament. I mean, it literally does now come down to one game in the semi-final, and you know, they'll play that you'd think England or India, depending on where the chips fall there. So, you know, can Australia put one performance together? I suppose it's just about these next three games are going to be, you know, about putting some performances together to make them in form for that semi-final. But I still think there's probably some holes in the lineup. I mean, the batting's been really good this tournament, you have to say. I mean, including that West Indies game, where they struggled early on. They managed, you know, Coulton Ayle came in and defined himself as to what he is. But the, you know, Finch and Warner at the top have been so good that I think they've actually created a bit of a problem down the order about, you know, how Smith and Khawaja come in, because they're not, you know, fast scoring hitters. But they've been given such a platform that it's like, oh, should we put Maxwell in now? You know, what about Carey? Bring him up. Stoinis, what's going on? You know, so Australia's batted really well this tournament. The bowling is a concern and what will ultimately, you know, cost us against England and India. But, good tournament. Good tournament for the boys. So I say we retain the trophy and let's go home.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth pointing out that they're in a far more stable position than many people have given them credit for coming into the tournament. You know,
Australia.
Now that we've watched them in the tournament, the idea that they make the semi is just it's just expected. Whereas going into the tournament, it wasn't as cut and dried as that.
No.
I know I've mentioned the dusting at the hands of South Africa at the start of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
and a couple of ODI matches against India as well, where they looked sort of off the pace. So to get to a point now where the problems are, oh, well, when do we bring Maxwell in from a batting point of view is a really good thing. You know, ultimately, it's going to be a bit of a hindsight World Cup. We're not going to understand how Australia's been going until they play the teams that we kind of measure ourselves against.
Well, but true.
You have to say that that they've done everything that they can until this point. And, you know, for the rest of the time, and I know it's to the chagrin of many listeners, you know, we're left to kind of try and understand their performances against those two teams, you know, understand what they've put forward and thought, is that good enough? And I do think there are still questions there, but let's just enjoy that they've hit 381 for five. Here goes Warner, 166, pardon me, off 147 rocks in the grade cricket parlance. You might have seen this. I put up on Twitter, not in a, like a baity way, but I put up on Twitter last night a question about whether someone could maybe explain to me the tactical argument behind Warner batting as the anchor or just batting within himself to kick off. And it wasn't meant to provoke people, though. You know, it is Twitter, so many people saw that as just a direct criticism of David Warner. Really, I genuinely was trying to understand, you know, what, why would you have him do that? Because clearly the brains trust and him feel like that's the best way for him to start. He ends with 166 off 147. I mean, can't have too many complaints there, but got to say, you know, still had some, you know, people texting me privately during that whole innings, a particular start, sort of, you know, wondering whether, you know, he's still, I mean, someone's going to get those runs, right? But was just wondering whether he still needed to go a little bit more quickly. But, you know, 166, can't argue with that.
Mate, I think it's, I think the Warner one's a really fascinating one because people are saying like, oh, he's, you know, he's a bit out of touch. And isn't it great that he can still, you know, put these runs on when he's not in his best form? The bloke's hit 200s. Like, he's in good form. You can't say, you can't watch, you know, his innings last night and think, oh, a bit scratchy. His feet are moving fine. He's middling most balls. He's hitting round the wicket. He's in good form. And he's come off the IPL where he was a leading run scorer. And by the way, in that IPL, he was hitting him at 143. So, you know, per 100 balls, that was his strike rate, 143. So it's clearly an instruction to bat slowly. Now, this is kind of goes to my point. I think like the almost the issue that Australia have got because Finch and Warner have started so well, I don't think at any point, apart from the West Indies game, they haven't got to 50. They put another 100-run stand on last night for the new ball partnership. Khawaja and Smith make sense at 3 and 4 if you're in a position where you're like, you're 2 for 30, you're sort of 1 for 10, because then you get a second chance where Khawaja can build his innings again. Now, Khawaja batted exceptionally last night, and he's got, you know, 89 off about 72 balls. So he's in the end batted really well. But like, Warner is clearly being told to bat slowly, and I don't understand why, when the only reason why you would have Khawaja and Smith down the order is back up for if you lose, you know, either Finch or Warner early to then bat 50 overs three innings. So I can't figure it out. But the notion that Warner is out of touch, or I saw actually Dan Bredig, friend of the show, posted a similar question last night, and his mentions were much less engaging, and they basically said, oh, well, Warner just wants to be the leading run scorer of the tournament. Shut the fuck up. Shut up. Why the fuck would you write that on the internet, you dopey fucking cunt?
Oh.
Anyway, so yeah, Warner's in good touch and Australia's going to win the World Cup is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it seems there's kind of, I sort of deduced two schools of thought with Warner. So there were people who were reasonably reputable who essentially had a spin on that argument that you've put away there, no holds barred. That there is something about him trying to get time at the crease, perhaps being selfish, you know, perhaps building a narrative that he's the leading run scorer, even if it's at the expense of the pace at which the team can go. You know, some have said to me they just can't fathom the idea that Langer or Ponting would tell David Warner to bat slowly to kick off.
Has someone in Bredig's comments said, well, he's just getting ready for the Ashes? What? He's in the World Cup. What are you talking about?
Yeah. The other school of thought is, and I heard this from someone you know, who knows him as well, is that he is technically struggling a little bit, but perhaps that struggle is, you know, a result of being curtailed by his coaches as well. So it's a bit of a symbiotic thing. We're discussing the problems of David Warner after he hits 166. I just want to say one thing on that. Of course, 166 is good. Of course, it's very good. Can I underline that three times?
It's good, mate.
Like England, the England side, and I know people hate me talking about the England side, but they teach us that there are 11 batsmen in a side, 11 batters in a side, and someone is going to score those runs off 300 balls. Mm-hmm. Somebody gets out going for it for, you know, 10, 20. Someone else comes in and picks it up and goes. So the individual milestone doesn't matter as much, you know.
Completely agree, mate.
You know, four guys hitting 60 or 40 balls rather than two guys hitting tons at a run a ball. Still feel like Australia is that latter thing. So again, 166, very good, but just look at the number next to it, 147. That's how many runs can you get off that amount of balls in an ODI. Now again, it's great that he scores that many runs, because when he scores that many runs, it allows Maxwell to come in and hit 32 off 10 before being burnt by Usman Khawaja, who decided he wanted to run and then thought, no, I don't want to get out, so you can get out, Glenn. I would like to score 100, and now I'm going to get out two balls later.
Yeah.
But that's the conversation that's going on. It's like, how do you best manage those 300 balls with the power that you have? And the question is, why is David Warner playing a role that makes him bat a little bit more circumspect at the start, or a little bit more within himself, which is a phrase that seemed to that a lot of UK people seem to enjoy. Is that not something that people have heard of in the UK, to bat within yourself? It seemed to be twisted into a masturbatory joke, which I'm all for as well.
Of course, yeah. Well, we did speak yesterday about Steve Smith having a bat in his room. Pez, I completely agree with that notion. And I was thinking about, you know, England's lineup during Dave Warner's blistering 166 from 147 rocks. And they have just, like, loaded up their team with, like, technically very good batsmen, but also just guys who can come in from ball one and just start whacking it. And, like, they figure if they get nine guys in their team who can do that, a couple of those guys per game are going to come off. Obviously, they've got Joe Root there, who sort of anchors the innings. He's, like, the one anchor of the innings. But even Joe Root is the slowest. Pez, you said to me off-air a while ago that, like, he's the slowest scoring batsman in their team, and he hits at about 102. Is that right? Something like that?
He was hitting at 88 coming into the tournament, and it was just an interesting comparison with Aaron Finch, who's the blaster of the Aussie side, who hits at 86.
Right. So that's England's play. Now, it's going to be interesting because Australia have every chance of beating England should they ever come up against each other in a, you know, in a knockout game. Obviously, it's going to be interesting to see what happens when we do play England on Tuesday, which would be a blockbuster game, obviously, for a number of reasons. But, I mean, I keep going back to the overall point of the tournament. It doesn't really matter where England and Australia and India and New Zealand finish necessarily, because you'd think Australia and New Zealand are going to have to play either England or India. And, like, I can't really... I don't really have a choice. I don't really have a preference about who I'd want to play in the semi-final, because they're both equally good. So it doesn't really matter, you know?
Yeah. I was trying to wonder whether there was an opportunity to play New Zealand in that semi-final, but I think they lose it. They've lost that now that they've lost to India.
Right.
India'd have to lose a match now, but if you could somehow get New Zealand in that game with respect to New Zealand, even though I've clearly disrespected them there.
You have.
Yeah, that would be... That would be handy. But, yeah, well, mate, it's just interesting. Like, Australia, that match against England is on Tuesday.
Mm.
We've got a big cast coming up on Sunday, actually. Looking forward to telling you who our guest is for that. But, yeah, that should be a good game. And, you know, yeah, we have our suspicions about Australia maybe playing a form of the game that's a little bit behind what the other guys are. But, you know, they have hit 380, one for five. I should say, in the interest of argument, for argument's sake as well, was put to me that perhaps the idea, you know, firstly, England haven't always started really quickly in this tournament as well. Mm-hmm. Even Bairstow was sort of 90 off 99 in his last match, and he can go a little bit quicker than that as well. So there have been some circumspect starts as a little bit of a trend. So maybe Australia's following a trend. Someone put it to me, because I just asked for a tactical argument, didn't ask for the social stuff, you know, and redemption stories or whatever, just tactically, why might they be doing that? Someone said, well, wickets can be a little bit tacky in England to kick off. That they might figure that small grounds means you need to load up, you know, for the end, and preserve wickets in hand so you can then turn it into a T20 or whatever. And, you know, that's maybe that's plausible as well. Someone else suggested maybe they're just protecting a weak middle order, the Australian side. Yeah, maybe. But I just would have thought that, you know, that middle order is really good at controlling things and, you know, going at a run of ball. So why start at that rate? But it's worked for them so far, mate. Yeah, the final one is, just to lab this point, the final one, maybe they're just foxing. Maybe Warner comes out and just goes at 200 in the semi, and it's all just sort of, you know, Sun Tzu shit.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting,
you know,
point.
Try not to know your enemy.
I think there is a thing of like the 10:30 starts that they're having. Like that, I think that probably is going to play a factor into how guys approach it. Especially if you lose a toss and you get sent in a bit of overcast conditions, 10:30, especially in the northern cities of the UK. Anyway, Glenn Maxwell came in and just looked like he was getting the time that he needed at the crease for his 9 balls before he was run out. And then, like,
to see him get some time at the crease.
Just, I think he's faced less than 50 balls yet he's batted in every game. Sure, he hasn't got to 50 yet, but, I mean, fuck, I love watching him bat. I mean, the talent of this guy is, like, I don't know if you saw the free hit that he got. Khawaja was facing, the no ball was given, took the single, Maxwell on strike. I think he'd faced 1 ball. And he hits this, like, inside out over mid off with like both feet in the air. That is unbelievable skill, and to middle that, it's crazy. He's hitting length balls, slower balls, like just middling them, you know, 75, 80 meters into the stats. I mean, like what a talent like Australia have. Hasn't been able to show it just yet, and it's a bit of a shame because like he looks in great form, as good as he can be for 9 balls. Disappointing. I think like Australia were on track definitely to hit 400 there, which, you know, probably eradicates all arguments of, you know, is Warner batting too slowly? If he ends up getting to 400, it's hard to it is hard to make the point. Although God help us, we've tried. But I'd love to see Maxwell bat for like 15 overs, just get a chance to bat 15 overs. But maybe he doesn't need to. Maybe he's the kind of guy who doesn't need that time in the middle, and like you just load him up for 1 big innings where he can score 100, you know, batting for 12 overs. I don't know. But geez, Khawaja had a bad 5 minutes there, didn't he? just absolutely burnt him. And then at that point you think, well, you're better off getting 100. And then he nicks a slower ball bouncer through to the keeper 2 balls later, and then doesn't raise his bat. He's walking on the field despite batting absolutely magnificently, I thought. So a couple of bad minutes there for Usman. Nothing else really happened. Steve Smith got 1, so we should speak about that. He's out of form. I need to be worried about that.
It's effigy time.
It's effigy time, I think, Sam.
Just on Maxwell there, he goes, okay. A friend of the show, Jeff Lemon, described that shot you were talking about as the off-balance helicopter.
Oh, yeah.
It is. It's just something to behold. He's just so special. I was talking to a few coaches recently. It wasn't that long ago that Langer's vision for Maxwell was to bat at number 7.
Yeah.
And there was uproar around the country about that. But, you know, I have to say, like, around that position or coming in with sort of 10, with maybe 30 balls to play with, which is essentially 10 overs to go, I mean, for me, that's the scenario where Maxwell is most likely to deliver for you. It stands to reason that if he's so good off those kind of 30 balls and can be so damaging, then why not give him more deliveries to face? Though through his career, and believe me, I have zero stats to back this up other than just what people have said to me.
Nice.
But through his career, coming in earlier hasn't necessarily worked for him. He did have that opportunity against the West Indies, it must be said. He was gone after 2 balls there, but so was everybody else. So it's kind of like the Steve Smith thing and the Warner and the Finch thing. Like with Maxwell, you know, 32 off 10, great innings. Would have been, there were still 20 more balls to go in that innings when he was completely run out by Khawaja, and the eyeballing that he gave Khawaja is just beautiful.
Yeah.
We should actually get a screenshot of it. That should be the picture of the show. That part of Australia's batting, that's set. That's really good. You know, if you can get Maxwell in the last 10 overs to go, you can do some serious damage if you're batting first, of course. You know, pieces seem to be falling into place, but let's just see how they match up against England and India. England's the next game. It's going to be really interesting.
Let's quickly talk about the bowling pairs.
Yeah.
No wickets for Cummins, no wickets for Maxwell, but then the wickets were shared between Stark, Coulter-Neill, Stoinis, and Zampa picked up one.
So
as
Cummins
well.
Dropped. So
Cummins dropped. Major concerns there. You know, I've been advocating heavily, as you know, Pez, because I've been talking to you about it for Hazelwood to come in, and I think it needs to be for Cummins, in my view. So I mean, it's not really much to report. I mean, this game was, even though Bangladesh, I almost said Zimbabwe there for some reason. Bangladesh were travelling at about 6.5 runs and over, 7 runs and over, up until about the 35th overish. So they're sort of in the game in terms of run rate. I just got the feeling that they're never really in it, you know. And it's like there's been so many of these games where teams chasing have fallen between between, you know, 40 and 150 runs short. And you know, just to bring back to the overall point of this World Cup, there has been a real lack of close games. Now, New Zealand had a close game against South Africa 2 nights ago, where they won with 3 balls to spare. So that's an exciting run chase, and in a match that meant something as well, because at that time it took New Zealand back to the top of the table, basically securing their spot in the top four. But you know, there are a lot of games where If you're putting 380 on the board, it's going to take a monumental effort, and you probably need a blistering start. I mean, you can't really be like 2 for 80 or 15 if you're chasing that. Not that Bangladesh were, but you see my point. Like Australia were winning that game from a long way out.
Yeah, it's just the nature of the World Cup, I think, mate. Where like because it's international, and because teams are at varying points in their kind of maturity as cricketing nations, 380 is going to be enough. It's not like what we've become accustomed to in short format cricket, especially T20s, where like no score is safe.
Yeah,
you know, with both sides that are normally equalised, you know, via systems. So it is easy to criticise in that sense, but it is kind of old school just to go, well, we've parked 380 on the board. It's impregnable. You're going to have to be perfect and then some to beat us. So it's just, there's kind of two tiers of competition, it feels to me.
Yes.
You know, there's the top four, then the rest, and the top four games I think are going to be played on a different plane to these ones.
Mm.
And they're about to come. I mean, look, there's some dead rubbers coming up in the World Cup. People are going to talk about it.
We are.
I wonder whether the ICC have kind of arranged the tournament so that even though there are dead rubbers, most of the top four fixtures now occur. So the only one that's happened so far is Australia-India. Now everybody's got to play each other.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right, Pez, let's get friend of the show, Adam Collins, on to talk about Australia's bowling innings specifically.
Great friend of the show, Adam Collins, on the line. If you don't know, he writes for everybody, commentates for everybody. His work is in high demand. He was at Trent Bridge overnight as Australia defeated Bangladesh. He's now currently in a Tesco's, I believe, getting a meal deal, a sandwich, some crisps, and a drink. Colo, welcome to the show.
It's all true. I've got the chips component. I can't find a fucking vegetarian sandwich. I'm a virtue signalling wanker that doesn't eat meat. So that's a great start. So please continue. Yeah, we were at the bridge and Australia did win.
We're at Trent Bridge and Australia did win. There's not really much else to say apart from that. Mate, can you, and this is a credit to you, unlike 99% of Australian cricket journalists and those who follow the game, you actually have an idea about the other side. What did this – let's start with Bangladesh. I mean, what did this mean for them? I know there's still a sliver of hope for them, but, you know, give us the Bangladesh perspective.
Well, that's their highest ever one-day international score, 333, beating the – 3:30 they made against South Africa a couple of weeks ago. So, I mean, they weren't ever going to win the game. The scorecard's a bit confusing. So they were probably closer than 48 runs. They were never going to chase down 381. But when Mahmudullah was trading them everywhere in the final 10 overs and Ushnik was making his way to 100, it just kind of felt like it was just special anyway. The fans were incredible. It was 98% Bangladesh supporters in there today. I tell you what, Australian supporters at this World Cup have not been seen. They must be selling all of their tickets to fans from the South Asian teams. And fair enough, you know, if there's a buck to be made, so be it. But the pet tigers, the stuffed tigers that the Bangladesh fans bring into the ground and all the colour of movement. Like, even though they weren't going to win, they were barracking like they were just about to win the World Cup themselves. Because in a way, you could argue that this is Bangladesh's most important World Cup game ever. I mean, granted, they knocked England out of the group stage last year, and yes, in 99 when they beat Pakistan, they got them test status. But if they beat Australia today, they've maybe not 1 foot in the semi-final, that's overstating it, but they've got a serious chance of making the semi for the first time. So I think that's why the support was so full on. And I think there's another element to this. They're too classy to say this, but privately, they fucking hate Cricket Australia due to the way they've been treated like shit forever. Since 2003, Bangladesh, they've never been invited to play another test series in Oz, having had several in the FTP, only to be postponed and cancelled. The one last year where Australia said that they wouldn't host them on the basis that, according to reports from Crick Info, which were well-sourced, that it wasn't commercially viable to play them because the television networks didn't want them to play them. I mean, you know, what is our sport if that's what it comes down to? And they've only played 19 one-day internationals across the, you know, I guess if you want to draw a line and say the 20 years since the 1999 World Cup. They haven't played a bilateral series against Australia in one-day cricket since 2011. They haven't been to Australia for a bilateral series for 11 years. There is so much disrespect shown by administrators towards Bangladesh. And again, they're too classy to say this publicly, but having had a little bit to do with them over the last couple of years, they view it that way. They view it as being thought of as the trash of the cricket world by Australian administrators. And I think today did mean an awful lot to them. So they didn't get over the line, but I think they were pretty keen to put in the sort of performance they could be proud of and turn a few heads. And I think they did, certainly with the bat.
Yeah, Colin, we've already spoken about Australia's batting. Let's talk about Bangladesh's batting and Australia's bowling. I mean, 8 wickets on a pretty flat Trent Bridge wicket. I mean, it's always a high-scoring affair there at Trent Bridge, famously. Yep. But have Australia bowled well there overnight, or is it or Bangladesh's batting just too good?
Oh, look, it was a bit of both. So there was an early run out, a brilliant run out, actually, from Aaron Finch. He's so good in the field. He made ground and hit one stump that he was looking at to remove Sumia Sarkar. And then that brought together the two most important Bangladesh players, really, in Tamim Iqbal and Shakib Al Hassan. They put on the better part of 100 before Shakib was done in by Stoinis of slow ball. So to break down the bowling, probably the most encouraging thing for Australia is that the supporting cast to Stark and Cummins, certainly the third and fourth seamer, Coulter, Arlen, Stoinis, were very good. So I don't think it was Cummins' best day of the World Cup. Probably wasn't Stark's either. In fact, it definitely wasn't Stark's best day of the World Cup. He took some taps towards the end, especially from Mushfiqur. But Coulter Isle back into the side ahead of Kane Richardson and ahead of Jason Berrydorf. I think he sort of reminded people that he's pretty good at cricket. I think that some people might have got on the Coulter Isle bandwagon and off very rapidly a couple of weeks ago, but he was excellent, especially when it mattered up front. And Stoinis, just having the balanced attack. The fact that Stoinis was there meant they had greater flexibility in their batting innings, and they were able to get 10 overs out of him, a couple of important wickets, including Shakib. So, it was a reminder of why all-rounders are so crucial in the 50-over format of the game.
It's certainly the salad 11 with Coulter Isle back in it, Colo. I know you've got a great salad yourself. If you consider Coulter Isle, Stoinis, Zampa, Cummins, there's some breeze blowing through those follicles as they come into bowl. And just in terms of, I mean, just want to just completely pivot, no Australians in the crowd. I mean, is that because they're investing a lot of their money into sort of negative gearing, which will probably take a bit of a bump with the recent election result?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only people there today who weren't Bangladeshi supporters were these two posh wankers who ran across the ground in like a semi-streaker type job.
Nice.
So they were wearing collared, dinner jackets they were dressed up nicely, pretty much. They were in a corporate box probably. And, you know, probably 8 bottles of wine in. They decided to run across from, I guess you'd say, deep extra cover to Cow Corner. And no one touched them. They just ran across in the middle of an over. And the stewards escorted them pretty much as they did it. They got to the other end and then they presumably got arrested at the other side of the ground. But imagine that happened in Australia. Imagine two blokes jump on the field and decide to chance their hand running across an international fixture at home. They'd be fucking pounded by the blokes in the bomber jackets. And fair enough, too. That's part of the deal, isn't it? If you want to run on the ground, you're going to pay $5,000 for a fine of that amount. It's going to be three times that much in Perth thanks to the mining boom. And you know, 4 hours in the cells at the MCG. And that's just your lot. By the way, if you ever do run on the ground and get stung for that, evidently, if you go to court and plead guilty, you just get it's like a couple $100. So if you ever run on the ground and do that, you don't get charged the full fare. I've got told that. It's only if you challenge it in court.
Good to know.
Given your audience, people will definitely try that on next year.
Just quickly, Colin, as well. I mean, are you saying therefore that the UK cricket grounds could probably use some behavioural awareness officers?
Yeah, but quite possibly for these two blokes. You're right about the salad 11. I see Coulson Isle's got a mustache now, which is kind of cool. I don't mind that. I think I've got better hair than all of them. I still think my hair's the best in the M25, but I mean, I'm willing to be challenged on it. I still think I can have it aligned.
Colo, if I've learned anything about these fans, you will be challenged on that. Mate, there's been a lot of chat about, you know, should the World Cup even be played in England because it rains there and no cricket game should ever be played where it rains anywhere. But I'm looking at, like, the crowds, yeah, and it's just such a... I mean, the UK is such a great hub of different, you know, especially cricket communities, you know, West Indies, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan. I mean, you know, there's obviously a huge Antipodean audience over there as well. I think it's just absolutely fantastic. But, I mean, obviously it has rained a couple of times and therefore ruined the entire World Cup. So, I mean, what would you say to people who question, you know, a World Cup event being held in the UK?
Yeah, I'll just remind people that reflexively say it rains in England, therefore don't hold the World Cup there. But on average, it rains more in Australia in March than it does in England in June. And when was the last World Cup held? In Australia in March. Like, this is just one of those things, right? Mm. So people that get fired up and want to sound off on Twitter about games being rained out, like, go for gold, whatever. But it doesn't matter because fundamentally the stats don't back it up. It's unfortunate. I wish it didn't happen. Last week was shit. No one's going to say anything other than that. But hopefully, you know, the bigger talking point isn't the weather. The bigger talking point is there's going to be 11 dead rubbers. Provided this World Cup goes on the trajectory that we think it will, and given that New Zealand won yesterday and Australia won today, it probably will end up that we have 11 dead rubbers. It was worked out a couple of days ago. That's the biggest scandal. But the format of the World Cup, set up by Australia, India and England to ensure that it got reduced from 14 teams to 10 back in 2011 when they first tried this on, and they eventually got there for this tournament. That's the problem, that we're going to have so much uncompetitive cricket at the back end of the tournament. The schedule was botched. It should be two groups of seven, but it's one group of 10, which always runs the risk of there being a big gap between the top half and the bottom. And the way the draw's been done, it's meant a lot of these blockbusters, quote unquote, so Australia, England, Australia, New Zealand, I think England, New Zealand, and India and England, those four games, which will probably be the four sides that make it through to the semis. They're all playing each other after all the sides are qualified already. Mm. So where's the incentive to bowl Mitch Stark against England, for example? I mean, there's the, you know, psychological warfare nonsense, but in terms of the actual practical application of seeing Mitch Stark, who's injury prone, playing an extra game against England, who he's going to want to have a degree of surprise, I suppose, against when he plays them in a game that means something. That's where the integrity of this World Cup is rightly being scrutinised and will continue to be so. Never forget, the reason why there's 10 teams in the World Cup and not 14 is because of a fuck up in the draw in 2007. Which meant that India got bundled out after three games. It's the only reason. The reason that Australia kowtowed to India, well, for the usual reasons, but the reason Australia backed it is that India wanted it this way. There's no excuse for it on cricketing terms. It's purely on the grounds of a mistake they made before the 07 World Cup, and we're paying the price for it 12 years later.
Mm. But Colo, can I just follow up with that? I mean, don't you think you should just get behind the boys?
Yeah. Back out, boys. Time to lads. You little fucking beauty. No, I said did well today. No, good today. Oh, to be fair, like, I think that they've exceeded expectations already in many respects. If we were having this conversation 3 months ago, we would have all said, if they make the semi-finals, pretty good result, right? I mean, they were rubbish in one-day cricket until they arrived in India and came back in that series and then subsequently in the UAE. I reckon that now they've pretty much all but made the final four. That's where they would have hoped to have got to, but wouldn't have necessarily expected it. If they make a final, it's an outstanding result for Australian cricket. If they win, just then, well, I mean, talk about timing your run perfectly, given the way that India and England have battered everyone over the last 4 years. So fair play to them. I think they're coming together really well.
Adam Collins, it's a pleasure, as always. Thank you for that combination of humour and genuine insight. We do appreciate it.
Bye, boys.
Look, to be honest, I don't try and take the piss too much, but the problem is you start to get a little bit bored. So I try and do the right thing by the competition, I must admit. Wow. When I go there, I try and play conventionally, but realistically, I'm thinking from ball one, I just want to park this fucking thing into the car park. But you don't want to come out of it and people say, look at that arsehole Hodgie, you know, so...
Yeah,
what a prick. But, yeah, I mean, it's good fun.
Hashtag AskTGC, Pezza. So yesterday we put out the call on the podcast for anyone who might have any information about the big question out there, which is on everyone's lips, i.e. just mine. Is Johnny Bairstow weird? And if so, how weird? So people have written in with a couple of stories. Actually, a lot of people wrote in, but I'm only going to read a couple. Jack Moorcroft writes in, says, "Re Johnny Bairstow. I have it on good authority that in his uni days, he was guilty of cutting off the music at pre-drinks, a prerequisite to preventing crippling social anxiety from taking over the room, and replacing said music with YouTube videos of his cricketing highlights. Went down terribly. Rare unit. I hasten to add that uni days refers to a period of time whereby, despite not attending Leeds University, Johnny was regularly in attendance at its parties." So, I mean, that's fucking... it's kind of alpha, like turning off music at a party and putting on his own highlights. Mm. I mean, so long as he is playing international cricket at this point, which I assume he was.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's obviously absolutely nothing to back this up that this is true, or any of these stories are true.
Just going
to
say, can I just put a disclaimer out there in the interests of maybe... the law that we're publishing these claims unverified. They're not verified. They may not be true.
Yes. They're almost definitely not true, Pez. But people have written in, so, you know.
Again, Jack Moorcroft, very sort of made-up name. It's a lot of made-up.
Blake's real name.
Names. But if indeed it's true that Johnny Bairstow would stop music at pre-drinks at uni parties to play his own YouTube cricketing highlights, mind you... these people would know that they're going to go and play for England.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cricket alpha. In the wider society, that's it's rare.
Yeah.
Because people don't, cricket's a special interest sport.
Yes.
But otherwise, yeah, pretty alpha. I just want to just personally also disclaim that just a summit on Johnny Bairstow being weird or not makes me uncomfortable. But it's one that I'll go through anyway for performance art purposes.
I just think, I mean, I've bullied you into this, you know, silently.
I've not been bullied.
But you're fucking being bullied, mate. So it's just, there's just something I just can't figure him out. I want the fans out there to help me figure him out just for my own. You know, I'm using this as just my thing. I mean, this is just, you know, hiding my own insecurities, basically.
Of course.
Nick Scott writes in, says, "Dear TGC, on the theme of Bairstow possibly being weird, at 10 a.m. on day two of the 2017 test at Old Trafford versus South Africa, myself and my brother had lined up 4 pints each, a saving of 16p or 15p a pint. We were sat a few rows back from the boundary and on the route from the nets to the dressing rooms and sighted Johnny Bairstow walking past. A few fans sat in front of us, called out to him for a selfie. He looked up and right past them to myself and my brother and shouted, 'Strong start on the beers, lads, but we'll see how you're doing at tea time.' By the tea break, we had several more beers and I'm led to believe South Africa were now in bat. Now my question to you is this. Is it more embarrassing that after attempting to alpha me and my brother, that Bairstow was out last week for 99, leaving Jimmy Anderson not out on 4? Or is it worse that by the end of the day, I had no idea that we had taken 9 wickets or indeed that there had been a tea break?" Well, this isn't about Johnny Bairstow at all, is it?
Is it more embarrassing? Is it more embarrassing that he got out for 99 in a test match or that he and his brothers got so drunk that they didn't know South Africa had taken 9 wickets or that England had taken 9 wickets? It was more embarrassing.
Yeah. It's Johnny Bairstow's 99, isn't it?
No, Johnny Bairstow's 99 without doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. And leaving Jimmy Anderson not out on 4.
Mm.
I appreciate your question, Nick. But that wasn't at all about Johnny Bairstow being weird in any way.
It kind of is. I mean, it's just his anecdote about people asking Bairstow for a selfie and Bairstow just looking past them and looking at four guys apropos of nothing and going, strong start on the beers, lads. Let's see how you're doing by tea time. Just wonder if he did indeed check on them at tea time. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, if he's caring, he would check in on them, hydrate them, get them some electrolytes. I don't know, mate. There were some other stories in there, basically, you know.
Can I read this? Oh, well, this isn't a Bairstow one next, sorry. Yeah, there was a lot of other stories that came in. He goes, some of them were concerning, but I guess that's what happens on the internet if you put a call out, as I did yesterday, for Bairstow stories. What are you going to expect?
Yeah.
You know, Nobel Prize winning journalism? No.
Yeah.
You're going to get trash. And there was some trash.
Yeah.
Anyway, any more stories, send them in. My favorite Steve Waugh stories. You're talking about stories that go against the myth and the narrative. Yeah. Steve Waugh, it's hard to beat Steve Waugh stories. And I don't mean that from a malicious sense. I just mean, you know.
Well, there was some, when we did put out the call, well, we actually didn't put out any call, but just like when we opened that up, there were just all of a sudden a plethora of, you know, emails, inboxes, DMs that were just like, oh, I've got my own Steve Waugh experience that went a little bit against the grain to what the public image is.
Yeah, that's right.
And they are funny. Just because also he's so dry. I like how Johnny Bairstow's weirdness has come into Steve Waugh stories now, but like he's just so dry and like that's why it's so funny. But let's move on, Pez. You want to read the next
one? Okay. Ben Blyton asked CGC, hey fellas, during a recent night out in Brisbane, I was walking through a bar and spotted someone sitting at a table that I was certain was famous. After going to the smokers area and Googling Sydney Thunder Spinner, I quickly realised it was Chris Green. I went over and got a picture and had a good hour long chat with him about all sorts of things, mostly his salad and legal bowling action. We became so friendly that I was even able to throw some jabs at him about his inability to spin the ball large distances. He had to go, and we shook hands and said goodbye. Does this sort of banter with a pro mean that I am able to DM him and hang out? Or does it mean I was just another dribbler and he was being a nice guy? Cheers, Ben. Pretty simple answer to this, I'd say. Here goes, after you.
Oh, yeah, definitely DM him. Yeah, get him on all social medias if you can. Try and get his phone number. Speak to his agent. You should definitely hang out. If you want to hang out with a professional, definitely go through their agent. That's the way to do it. Ben knows the answer to this question. Anyone listening to this knows the answer to the question. Because there's just a lot going on. First of all, he wants to be best mates with a guy who he had to Google in the smoker section.
How did he know to Google Sydney Thunder Spinner?
Well, I think he just recognised Chris Green, who is, in my opinion, the best-looking cricketer that has ever existed. He's better looking than Brendan Julian.
Yeah.
Just without the baggy green cap.
He's smoulders. So
I think what would have happened is he would have seen Chris Green's face and like I recognise that in a green shirt, and there's only one green domestic T20 franchise, and that is obviously the Melbourne Stars. Sydney Thunder. So that's why he's done that, I think. And then he's sledged him about not being able to spin it. And then the next sentence is, he had to go and say goodbye. Yeah, shocking that those things coincided. That he just met a bloke in a pub who wanted to talk to him about cricket, then sledged him about not being able to spin it, which is, great chat.
He goes, we just hear this, like we experience this phenomenon quite a bit now. This phenomenon of people being friends with you or being friendly, inverted commas. But when you actually look at the content of what they've said to you, it's usually quite aggressive or critical. And now Ben has had three items of content with Chris Green, his new best mate. One, his salad. Admittedly, it's a great salad and that would have just been a nice compliment. Two, his legal bowling action. And three, his inability to spin the ball large distances. So basically he's gone up to him and over the course of an hour, a good hour-long chat with him, he talked about all sorts of things, one good thing and two things that speak to his professional life, his legal bowling action, which is obviously a sarcastic comment on the way he bowls, and the fact that he can't spin the ball. Like the two things he actually does, oh, yeah, I love talking to him about chucking it and how he can't spin it. Man, I'm sure he'd love that. It's funny that literally as soon as you put the full stop there, Ben, the next line is he had to go.
But isn't this every interaction? I mean, we're starting to experience this, you know, with the good people who, you know, buy VIP tickets to our shows. No, they're good people. They're good people.
And keep buying.
GreatCricket.club for all your World Tour live show tickets. I've done it again. Done it again. Slipped it in there. Ben, I have it on authority. I've a close friend of mine is good friends with the Green family, and I have it on authority there that Chris Green is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. So Chris was following that up. It's another story of Chris Green being a nice guy. I'm not sure what he was doing in Brisbane. Probably trying to figure out his legal bowling action. Maybe it's where he's frosted tips. I'm not sure. Ben, I would not DM him. I think you should take away that experience.
Stay clear.
You've now written about it, you know, to two guys on a podcast, and we've spoken about it for 10 minutes. So
I'll tell you what, we're looking, we'll get him on the show at some point in the next little while as well. So we can ask him about you, Ben, and your fledgling friendship.
I thought you might get Ben on the show.
It would be funny. Do you remember him? I mean, that'd be a really funny segment.
Do you remember him?
Do you remember me? And we'll get people on, and you can, like, somehow we'll get a radio show or something. I mean, that's just so flippantly.
Isn't that our segment? Do you remember me? That's basically what all of our questions are to former players. Anyway,
let's talk about this.
Anonymous, stop having business meetings on the podcast. Anonymous writes in, he says, "Hello, gentlemen. I wish to remain anonymous. I have less of a grade problem, but more of an alpha problem that I'm sure you'll be able to help with. One of my best mates has known this girl since he was a toddler and allegedly fancies her. Allegedly, because he refuses to confirm. She recently broke up with her boyfriend, which gave me heavily beta best friend a chance at the prize. Yet only a few days after the breakup, one of my other mates ended up engaging in an activity with her at a party that involved his fingers and lasted approximately 20 minutes.
That's gross, mate.
My question really is, what does my friend do and how do I help him during this time? By the way, he's ginger with no pipes, chest or salad, and is a sketchy medium-paced tail-ender, so he's not exactly been blessed." So this guy allegedly fancies a girl and has done for a while. His friend has hooked up with her at a party. And so what does he do?
I don't know. I just, my head went into fuzz when he started to describe what actually happened. What does he do? I don't know, mate. If you're going to burn your friends or anything like that for a girl, you know, like you're not a friend of mine. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's right, mate. I mean, he signs off with, by the way, he's ginger with no pipes, chest or salad. I mean, I was thinking it could have been Bairstow writing in here, but he's got decent salad, to be fair. Old Johnny, so.
You don't rate his pipes or chest?
They're okay. Bairstow's all right. Bairstow's all right in that sense. I don't know what you do here. I mean, the obvious answer is to quit cricket and get massive. That is, you know, I mean, bodybuilders have been created by many times by, you know, relationships breaking down. You know, heartbreak does form bodybuilders. It's a famous cliche that happens. So look forward to your friends just getting to the gym, quitting cricket, never seeing him again because he'll be taking small bits of Tupperware to house parties as he's counting his macros. Talking about chest and back routines. That's what I do anyway. And look how happy I am.
It just sounded super familiar. That's like, you just, you know, it's just like what you said yesterday about, oh, we should do a Faf Duplessis routine with the towel. So we're offered to go to a hens party. Just said it with just some real expertise there. Just suggested maybe that's happened before. He goes, have you ever taken Tupperware with your protein and macros or whatever the fuck you call it to parties before? Have you done that?
No, I've never done that. Okay. I wish I had a story there to follow it up, but I don't. No, I've never done it to that extreme. I don't know what Anonymous does. You know, look, it's a tricky situation, but I mean, the only answer is to just get absolutely ripped. Because that's, you know, revenge is the best form, of acceptance here. So revenge is the best form of acceptance. I don't even know what that means.
I'm really enjoying you mumbling about weightlifting or bodybuilding this last few minutes. You know, your mind's drifted off somewhere else to some kind of scorn that you've received from a woman, and that's obviously prompted you to get massive yourself because you keep talking about it.
Sorry, I forgot we were doing the podcast for a second. Yeah. Sorry. I thought it was just two blokes just having a chat over the internet. All right. Well, thanks so much for that question, Anonymous, that I definitely wrote in myself. Pez, England and Australia go head-to-head on Tuesday, yeah. But our next podcast will come out on Monday Australian time before that. So huge, huge game next up, and then the winner basically takes all. So see you then.